Good morning. I want to welcome you here this morning and offer you an opportunity to pick up a bulletin in the back if you have not, if you do not have an outline. If you do, please get it out in front of you, and we're going to go ahead and turn to Psalm 19 to begin this morning. And when we talk about doing things decently and in order, we usually have a thing in mind, and they're from 1 Corinthians chapter 14. If we get the context of what's going on and we see the things that are happening there, especially in context of the whole of the Corinthian letter, the letter of 1 Corinthians anyway, we get an idea, a sense of what is going on there, especially as we saw last week, the chaos that was going on in regards to the Lord's Supper. And while they were taking the Lord's Supper correctly, we saw that one of the major problems was that they had disunity outside of that. That they refused to have unity one with another, and they were very chaotic in the way they were handling things and handling one another. So what I want to look at this morning is when we use the concept of doing things decently and in order, there was a point that Paul had when he was communicating this. There was a point that the Holy Spirit was attempting to make through Paul when he recorded those words. And I want to look at how God attempts to create order out of chaos. In Psalm 19, if you look at verse 1, he says, "The heavens declare the glory of God, and the firmament shows His handiwork. Day unto day utters speech, and night unto night reveals knowledge. There is no speech nor language where their voice is not heard. Their line has gone out through all the earth, and their words to the end of the world." If you stop there a second, this is highly poetic. And so there's a bit of interpretation that needs to go on, because when you look at the literal words, they don't make a whole lot of sense in and of themselves. He says that, obviously, verse 1 is fairly simple. The heavens declare the glory of God. You look at the sky, you look at the world around us, and it speaks, uncommon to popular belief in today's world, it speaks to a creator. It speaks to the excellence of that creator. It speaks to the amazing nature of that creator. And in verse 2, he says, "Day unto day utters speech." The fact that the cycle continues speaks volumes to the consistency of the one who created the system. And he'll go on in verse 4 through 6, talking about the sun specifically, so we'll leave that for now, but that's what he's saying. "And night unto night reveals knowledge." That is to say, you learn something by just seeing that this pattern continues again and again and again. He says, "There is no speech nor language where their voice is not heard." Every communication, every language, not only has words for day and night, in the most literal sense of what he's saying here, but think about hyperbolically, think about poetically, and how many those concepts transcend, right? They transcend just the physical, well, the first 12 hours of the day, in most cases, in Jewish culture was night, right? Because it goes 6 p.m. to 6 p.m. And so the first 12, that's night. And we say, well, the word night exists in a lot of languages. Yeah, but it's also used in a lot of those languages, in all of those languages, metaphorically, to mean something. Usually in darkness, we're talking about oftentimes evil, because evil things are done in the darkness. When we talk about day, we're talking about good things, things that are happening in the light. Right? So it's not just in the traditional sense of, hey, every language has the word day and has the word night. Isn't that interesting? What the psalmist is saying is that these concepts transcend language. The ideas behind these concepts of light and darkness, of day and of night, those are significant to the human condition. They matter to humanity and to our way of thinking. He says, "Their line has gone out through all the earth, and their words to the end of the world." Everybody understands these concepts. And if you look back, Genesis chapter 1, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And what does it say there in verse 2? "And the world was without form and void, and darkness was on the face of the deep." Now, if I called that anything, I'd call it chaos. I'd call it a mess. And then God spoke. And He spoke, "Let there be light." And there was. And then He spoke many things following that. And through those first 4 days, God separated a lot of things. He created the stars and the sky and the sun and the moon. He created the firmaments in the heavens. He created all of these divisions. He ordered the way the world works. In Romans chapter 1 and verse 20, we find that his invisible attributes are clearly seen, being demonstrated by the things which exist, to the degree that he argues even these Gentiles, they have no excuse for not coming inevitably to an understanding of God, not pursuing an understanding of God. They have inferior understanding because they have satisfied themselves with what they have been told. And that's the world we live in, is it not? As intelligent and as wise as this world thinks it is, and as scientific, and I like to use that word in the most liberal way possible, because science is not what I believed it was when I was a kid. When I was a kid, I loved science, I loved mathematics, because it was supposedly, and it is in its purest form, a pure work. When I multiply 2 times 2, every time I do it, I get 4. And if I add certain chemicals to other chemicals, the result of that experiment will be the same every time if I have the purity of chemicals to begin with. And yet, the world has taught, and this culture, not just here in America, but the scientific culture, and again, I use that word exceedingly loosely, teaches that the world came from nothing. And I love Trisha's class, and I'm sure a lot of teachers have used this illustration, but my kids, they came home doing this, thinking that it was the coolest thing, and they say, okay guys, get out your nothing, now make something out of it. And you can't make something out of nothing, and we all understand that, that is a logical inconsistency, and yet that is the idea that the scientific community, the supposed scientific community, proposes. And then you go beyond that into how the world has not only come about, but then how it has developed over time in the process of time, and how the whichever form of evolution that individuals believe in, either evolution through natural selection or evolution through mutation, neither of those are consistent with what we see around us. The results of either of those situations, we don't see. We see a clearly delineated species, or specieses. Species, I think it's plural in and of itself. I don't know, maybe it's like moose, and you don't say niece, though I think you should, because that would be cool. Anyway, so you have delineations of species. You have cats, and you have dogs, and you have horses, and you have all of the delineations that go on. There is an order to things. And who created that order? And the scientific community would say, well, it just happened. It just is. Because it can't be any other way. Well, that's only because they have eliminated the one answer that truly makes any sense, is that God ordered the chaos. God ordered the chaos. 1 Corinthians chapter 14, verse 33, he is not the author of confusion, we read just a second ago, and we will go back there in just a few minutes, and we will see what, in more particular, he is talking about there. But that is certainly the case when we talk about the creation of the world. When we look around, and we see the things that exist, there is no higher explanation, there is no better explanation than God. And you could spend your time, and I have done some research into this. I have purchased the books of the most well-respected atheists. I have them in my library. If you were interested in reading them, they are garbage. Because they outrightly eliminate God for absolutely no reason. And when I was a kid, I believed that science was a pure thing. And science is. But what people have made look like science is not a pure thing. It is not as consistent and forthright as it is intended to be. It is not what they present it to be. That, evolution, is not science. And they try to make it into a law instead of a theory. It's not even a good theory. And theories have to be tested again and again, and they have to be consistent with the results that you receive, and it is not. And yet it is brought down. Every book you get that talks about any span of time uses millions of years or billions of years, and there is simply no evidence for it. And it is frustrating to live in this world that refuses to accept that God draws order out of chaos. You talk about an earth and the universe that demonstrates this, and the way they think the earth came into existence, and the way the processes that exist that keep us alive, that allow life to be sustained on this small planet, All the things that have to go into it in order for us to even exist in the first place, according to their theory, it'd be like a tornado going through a trailer park and leaving a functional and fully working 747. Because we see that all the time, don't we? I mean, we have plenty of tornado going through trailer parks or homes, going through all kinds of places. And you know what's not left after all of it's said and done? Anything. Anything that remotely resembles something working. Everything's destroyed, utterly. And nothing is left in its wake. There is the evidence of a designer. So when we talk about decency and an order, we really need to communicate and think about what that means to the God who created the heavens and the earth. Because He's the one who authored those words there in 1 Corinthians chapter 14. He is the one that those words are coming from. And so we talk about decency and an order, we have to look at the world around us. And though from our small and skewed perspective, the world looks chaotic, very much like a mouse in a maze. I can't imagine to the maze looks all that definitive or all that well-defined. And yet, to the creator of the maze, He set it up to be specifically for the mice, to work the mice in specific ways, to test certain reactions or functions of their senses, to see how fast they could learn and move through that maze. Whatever the case might be, there was a reason for the creation of that maze. Does the mouse realize the creation of the maze? No, it's just in the maze. It's just running from place to place, trying to get the things done that it feels needs to be done. That is us. And it's not a pleasant picture of us, but that's us. And God has ordered this world. And He draws that order out of chaos so that even when things go wrong, and this leads up to a conversation I just had with someone here. Wednesday, I go into surgery, supposedly, if it works out this time. And I'm not concerned about it. Because I know that the Lord, He has control of the world. And nothing is going to change that. And nothing is going to change my confidence in Him. Because the Lord draws order out of chaos. He uses the sun. He's already talked about the day and the night. But if you go on to the end of verse 4, maybe there's a break in yours. Again, the separation of verses is man-made. So it is sometimes cumbersome and inconvenient the way they separate verses and chapters. But just keep that in mind so that you don't just cut verses off or add verses to simply because the numbering of the verses or the chapters. But in what we would consider the second half of verse 4, he says, "In them He has set the tabernacle for the sun, which is like a bridegroom coming out of his chamber. And rejoices like a strong man to run its race. Its rising is from one end of the heavens, and its circuit to the other end, and there is nothing hidden from its heat." He says the sun illustrates His consistency. It never fails. It never tarries. Genesis chapter 1 and verse 5, the evening and the morning were the first day. And if our calculations of the time between the day that the world was created and this is sometimes, it is somewhat speculative because we don't know exactly how many generations are. There are some times that we don't know how long someone lived. But we estimate the world has been in existence for 6 to 10,000 years. And if that is the case, then it was approximately 1,500,000 days. And I say that approximately between the time that the morning and the evening were the first day and it happened every way or every day that way. To that day in Joshua chapter 10, verses 12 and 13, where Joshua, pursuing the enemies of God, prayed that the sun would stand still, and it did. 1,500,000 days that it happened exactly the way God initiated it. And the only person who could change it was God. And so He did, because it was prudent for Him to do so. And He changed it. And then what happened? The day and the night, the cycle started all over again, just as it always had. We even have songs that we sing about that. The sun will come out tomorrow. Which is to say that even though your day is not going very well, if there is a tomorrow, the sun will come out. And that's not to say it will be hidden behind clouds or you won't have a rainy day. But the earth will turn as long as the Lord allows it. And we will be here as long as the Lord allows. And we say these kinds of things to help give comfort to people through their lives in difficult days that there is a new day dawning soon, because the world was built by a consistent, by an orderly God. He goes on in verse 7. Notice with me here. Verse 7, he says, "The law of the Lord is perfect, converting the soul. The testimony of the Lord is sure, making wise the simple." I love that. That reminds me of me. That is to say, the simple that are made wise because of his words. I am not a terribly intellectual individual, and the only time I have wise things to say is when I speak them from God's word. And most of the time, things that come out of my mouth are not terribly wise. Ask my wife. But when I communicate the word, and this is what I love about being a preacher, a proclaimer of the gospel of Jesus Christ, when I take it out into the world, and when you all can too, when you have opportunity to speak the word to people, you know it is consistent beyond all things that you will ever say. That those things are true even more than anything you could ever communicate. And that is what I love about being a preacher, is that I don't have to wonder and question about the things that I am communicating. If it is God's word, if it is directed by His covenant that we are in, then it is something that should be done or shouldn't be done, and there are no questions about the things that He has illustrated to us. The law of the Lord is perfect, He says. The testimony of the Lord is sure, making wise the simple. The statutes of the Lord are right, rejoicing the heart. The commandment of the Lord is pure, enlightening the eyes. The fear of the Lord is clear, or clean, enduring forever. The judgments of the Lord are true and righteous altogether. More to be desired are they than gold, yea, than much fine gold, sweeter than any honey and the honeycomb. Moreover, by them your servant is warned, and in keeping them there is great reward. And we talk a lot in this life about reward. When I worked at 80/20, there were people who would switch jobs because they were going to get paid 50 cents more an hour. And I was always wondering, well, what kind of benefits do they have? Because that should play into your decision. And how much is the deductible that you're going to pay if you get injured or you get sick? Or what kind of things are involved? And nobody wanted to think about those kinds of things. They just thought the bottom, they thought of the top line. Because that's not the bottom line, that's the top line. They thought only of the top line. Well, I'm going to get paid 50 cents more an hour. This is a better job. And wouldn't you know it? It wasn't 6 months later they came back to 80/20 because the working conditions at 80/20 were better. The insurance was better. Like, all kinds of things were better. And all they were offering was 50 cents more an hour, which seems like a lot. But when you consider all the things going on, it wasn't worth the change. It wasn't worth the transition. It wasn't worth what you were giving up. The law, he says, establishes consistency. And the word law rarely nets a positive reaction. Most people think of the law as a burdensome, as a restrictive. If you're a teenager, you tell your parents, "You're ruining my life because you make rules." I'm not sure I ever said that, but I probably said that indirectly. The purpose of the Torah was not to be burdensome or restrictive. It wasn't to just be a problem or a nuisance. It was to guide and direct and instruct. That God wanted His children to understand the rules that they were living by so that they could perform the actions that would be best for them. When my parents made rules, and even if I didn't realize it at the time, later on, usually, I realized that their rules were meant to help keep me safe. Even if they at times felt burdensome and cumbersome and restrictive. And even if it wasn't what I wanted to do, I realized in most cases that they were absolutely right. That their rules made sense, even if I couldn't see it at the time. And the Torah, in this case, the five books, or the books of the law as you would call it in the Old Testament, because that's who we're dealing with. We're dealing with the psalmist who lived under the law. He recognized that even though the law contained some more than 300 different commandments, not just the Ten Commandments, but more than 300 commandments altogether, that it was a guiding force. It was instruction. It was direction for our lives because God was attempting to order the chaos of our lives. You leave a teenager without instruction. You leave a child without instruction. You leave an adult without instruction. And you get a mess. You get a mess. And so God was attempting to order the chaos of our lives. And in it, He directs us to do certain things that are beneficial not only in the immediate, but ultimately in the inevitable. When he calls the Jews to leave the corners of their fields for the poor and the weak and the lame to be able to feed themselves. When he communicates to the Jews to take care of individuals who are strangers in their lands, to help people when they have opportunity to give rest. It is more than just the Ten Commandments that God has instructed the Israelites with, the things that you do and things that you don't do. It is the plethora of communication from God to man to help them understand how they need to live. And when we talk about things like that, when we communicate about order, about decency, we need to remember that these words, they transcend this new covenant. Now, there's a point that Paul is making here in 1 Corinthians 14, if you go with me there now. There in 1 Corinthians 14, there is a specific point that Paul is making. But to look at this world and to see the order that God has instilled in it, he has created this order, he has established it, he has demonstrated it numerous times, and then he gives it to us in order that we might have order out of the chaos of our lives. And we sometimes are seen by the world around us and they ask, how can you have peace in times like this? Hopefully we have that peace. Hopefully we recognize that God is in control, that he has ordered the things of this world, that he is the master of this place and this time, and that I might be running in this maze, but I love the one who made it, and he loves me. And when we think like that, then we can move through this life with a different purpose, a different mindset, a different hope than the world has. They hope simply to survive. I hope to have life and to have it more abundantly, because that is what the Lord offers. In 1 Corinthians 14, you have to get a context of what's going on, and we could go all the way back in 1 Corinthians and we could get a big context of what's been going on. They have so many problems right now, though it's incredible going to 2 Corinthians and seeing the solutions that Paul is demonstrating, or that Titus demonstrates to them, and the hope that Paul has and the changes that they make. It's incredible the transition that they make. But if you go to chapter 14, verse 6, he says, "But now, brethren, if I come to you speaking with tongues, what shall I profit you unless I speak to you either by revelation, by knowledge, by prophesying, or by teaching?" He's saying, if you can't understand what I'm saying, what is the point of me talking? And that's the way a lot of times the religious services have been withheld from people, or the purpose of religious service has been to speak in these tongues, or to communicate to people in ways that weren't to demonstrate their own superiority, to make them look good. The motivation is to be heard and be praised by men instead of to praise God and to demonstrate his word to the people. In verse 9 he says, "So likewise you, unless you utter by the tongue words easy to understand, how will it be known what is spoken? For you will be speaking into the air." You might as well be talking to a wall, that's what we would say. They say you might as well be speaking into the air, because no one is going to understand what you're saying. And the purpose of communication, the purpose of preaching, the purpose of teaching, the purpose of singing and praying is for, and what we'll see here, edification, verse 12. "Even so you, since you are zealous for spiritual gifts, let it be for the edification of the church that you seek to excel, not the glorification of yourself." And that's what these individuals were pursuing, being glorified by the individuals around them. Instead, they needed to consider, how can I better the church? How can I better the people around me? How can I make their lives easier? How can I be helpful to them? And he says, "Therefore, let him who speaks in a tongue pray that he may interpret. For if I pray in a tongue, my spirit prays, but my understanding is unfruitful." And when he says a tongue, he means another language. Now, I don't know any other languages very well. I took German in high school, 3.5 years, and I can barely say anything. That was very successful schooling, I guess. I have a decent understanding of Greek, but only on paper, because my communication in Greek is awful. And so I don't have a lot of excellent ways of speaking in other languages, but I have heard individuals who could speak in 10 or 12 languages. They had an affinity for languages and communicating in them. But if one of those individuals, as eloquent as they could speak,